Charlie White wins a vote. Does it change his political future? Federal judges strike down two new laws. Was a lawmaker wrong to strike back? A major move's anniversary, new laws take effect, and say goodbye to cursive writing in Indiana schools. That and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 1, 2011.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, the State Recount Commission ruled that Charlie White is eligible to serve as Secretary of State. It was a 3-0 bipartisan vote. White appeared tense as he arrived with family members for the conclusion of a challenge that began following his election last year. Democrats charged that White committed voter fraud by living with his second wife while keeping his voter registration at the home of his ex-wife. They say he did it to keep a seat on the Fishers Town Council. But the Recount Commission found that it couldn't prove that White intended to commit voter fraud, so it rejected the Democratic challenge, even though Chairman Thomas Wheeler said he is troubled that White will oversee the election system. Wheeler told White that while there was no specific evidence of fraud, he was, quote, treading on the line. White returned to his statehouse office before addressing reporters.
I never thought in a million years that politics would get so personal and dirty. I hope this never happens to anybody again.
Will the recount commission vote matter when White goes on trial? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Dan Parker, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Kenzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Dan Parker, why did the Democratic appointee on the commission vote in favor of Charlie White?
Well, I can honestly say that I was the only person who appointed somebody who was impartial to the panel. But I think that this was a complicated hearing. And this was not a criminal hearing. This was not a typical civil hearing either. There was no chance to depose Charlie White beforehand. No one knew what he was going to say, what story he was going to bring. And therefore, you had no opportunity to bring evidence with you that contradicted his story. And so if evidence was presented without a contradiction, it was deemed to be
You're saying he was lying?
We'll see in the criminal trial.
but you appointed, this was your challenge. You brought the challenge.
Correct.
You appointed one of the commission members, mm-hmm. and you lost that vote.
Well, it's a difficult case to prove when they're using the intent in his verbal intent to say that one residence, at the end of the day, one residence was his address to get the Fishers Town Council money, and one was his address to get a $259,000 loan.
So the question is, when you stand back and look at this, was this a case where the law was applied accurately, or was this a case where the commission didn't have what it took to take this man out of office and replace him with a Democrat, and they made the law fit?
I think this is a place where the law was applied accurately because, in Indiana, thanks to the Evan By case, the residency is where you say it is, basically. And as long as I was told before this ever started that if he was consistent with his story, and when you have both the ex-wife and the current wife testify that he was staying at the first wife's house 4 or 5 nights a week, and they stayed with that throughout the thing. I think he was in the clear because I think all three members of the Recount Commission voted the way the law required them to vote in this one. Now, his problems are still ahead of him, clearly, when he has to go through the criminal trial, but I think all three of these folks did exactly what they were required to do.
You know, you talk about keeping the story straight, and you're right. He and his current wife and his ex-wife all told the same tale. The problem, though, is that what he said.
What do you say is a tale?
Let me finish. It's different. It's a departure from what he told reporters back in the fall about the timeline and when he moved into the condominium. And I mean, the whole notion about staying in the ex-wife's basement because that came out of nowhere. I mean, it wasn't mentioned in the fall when he talked about this issue. So you talk about keeping. I'm just making a point about keeping stories straight. There's a departure from. Right. From his story in the fall and his story now.
Tail sound like an editorial comment to me.
Well, in the meantime, we saw all these attempts by Charlie White to keep from testifying, to seek immunity for his testimony. I mean, is it fair to presume that he said things in front of the Recon Commission that got him over that hurdle that might, in fact, get him in more trouble in a criminal case?
Well, I think Mike is right in that the criminal case is where he's still faces an extreme challenge. There will be evidence brought by the prosecution. There will be refutation of the evidence that he may present in the trial. And the inaccuracies that John made reference to may play a key role in the criminal trial that didn't happen in this recount commission hearing. So whether or not it gets him into more trouble, I think it provides more grist for the case. And we'll find out in August what happens.
The real significant development this week is that the Democratic challenge failed, which means that Bob Osley, the Democrat who came in second, won't be the replacement. I mean, if Charlie White is removed in a criminal proceeding, then he's replaced by a Republican. Or that's true. Do you appeal this?
Well, we have 30 days to figure out whether we want to appeal. I mean, it has to be based on the legal findings at the end of the conclusions of law that the commission made.
So you haven't decided?
We haven't decided yet. I mean, you have to have a different set of eyes. You got to read the opinion. But I think that the ability to be able to call, say, like the mortgage broker, when Charlie White sits there and says he didn't read his mortgage documents and he didn't provide the information to his mortgage lender, the prosecutors are going to have a bigger say with that than other folks. And the other thing is that we are breaking new ground here. You now have the ability to claim residence if you're a non-custodial parent, if you crash, Mike. He didn't say four or five times a week. He said, I crashed it.
One of the wives.
Mike, I sat through all 7 hours of the hearing.
I read the testimony.
You didn't read the testimony. I was there.
No, I did read the testimony. Don't tell me I didn't.
He said he crashed at three separate locations.
Well, he was there. And he said he was there four or five. One of them said he was there four or five times.
This was a victory.
Let me ask you this question.
If it's a 3-0, if it's a 3-0 vote, isn't that problematic on the appeal process? And
no.
You replaced the Bob Guzman and put the judge on there. I mean, was that a mistake on your part?
Well, the judge was roundly criticized by your party. Are you taking all that back?
I never criticized him at all.
Well, your state party chair did.
I think his reputation was that he's a guy that's going to play this straight up, and I think he did.
You know, this isn't what your state party chair said.
Well, John, he's not me.
This is a victory, of course,
for the Republicans and for Charlie White.
Right. Maybe not for Republicans generally, although the point's well taken.
No matter what happens, they keep the office.
But why I'd say it might also be a victory for him in the larger scope is something you, I think, have brought up before, Jim, that now he has a bargaining chip, perhaps. He still retains the office as he goes into the criminal trial. If, in fact, there is some sort of possibility of a plea agreement. If he had lost his seat now, if the recount commission had said you weren't eligible, you don't have the office, then what bargaining chip would he have had going into the criminal proceedings? This way, and I'm not saying that this is going to happen, but if he wants to keep his law license, if he wants to stay out of jail, that could be a bargaining chip that would carry the day.
The loser in all this is Charlie White. His defense was, I didn't know I couldn't move out of my district. I didn't read any of my mortgage documents. I don't know anything about being law.
That's the testimony I was talking about that he may not want to come up in the criminal trial.
Well, that's right. And the person who I think is really instrumental in all of this, interesting, I should say, and the book I'm waiting for is Gordon Dernils. Gordon brought the challenge to Evan Bias residence and was on the commission this time around. So
you think his position's changed?
I want to see what Gordon's book says.
Moving on. A federal judge blocked a portion of Indiana's new immigration reform law this week, and a state senator fought back on the internet.
Sarah Evans Barker is a Ronald Reagan appointee to the federal bench. She's a Republican who previously served as U.S. attorney. But State Senator Mike Delf posted messages on Facebook and Twitter following Barker's ruling on the immigration bill he authored that ignore that history. Liberal elitism is choking America, especially our halls of justice, he writes in one tweet sent on Saturday. In another, he says, judicial reform is grossly needed at both the national and state level. One of the great American lies is that judges are apolitical. The two messages are combined in a single posting on the state senator's Facebook page. Delf is a law school graduate who is studying for his second attempt to pass the bar exam. If he was an attorney already, his comments could get him in ethical trouble, said Bill Jonas of the State Bar Association when told of Delf's tweets. I would counsel any applicant for the bar against intemperate criticism of any judicial official.
Mike McDaniel, is Senator Delf out of line?
He gets, as I'm told in this situation, because he's an elected official, that most courts won't really touch having an elected official. They have a right to basically, because they're elected, to say what they want to say about these kinds of things. But on a practical side, if you're getting ready to take the bar exam you want to pass it, you got to wonder what he's thinking when he's criticizing. Although he says he's not criticizing this judge specifically, that it was general comments he was making.
Well, but he also said that he was criticizing all judges, not to exclude Sarah Evans Barker.
On a practical side, you got to wonder what he's thinking and why was it even necessary at this point.
Your thoughts?
Well, for the record, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to take the bar exam for the second time. Has he ever been quoted as saying that Ronald Reagan is his hero? Because Sarah Evans Barker was appointed by Ronald Reagan. I mean, come on. He may have the right to do it by being an elected official, but being an applicant for the bar, it's pretty stupid.
Does this hurt his cause going forward?
I think it hurts the cause of good government going forward, because these kinds of intemperate remarks really inflame the whole attitude that people have about the separation of powers and about people and their attitude toward government. The more we just continue to fight and diminish the opposition, the more it hurts the process. And I think that it's time for people who are in public office and people here on this set to, make sure that our comments are made in a fashion that aren't, trying to tear down the process.
We can still raise our voices.
Yeah, you can still raise your voice.
Clearly, I'm not a lawyer either, but it does strike me that these kinds of comments, they show maybe a lack of understanding of what the role is of the judiciary in our country. At the risk of sounding like a civics lesson, the refrain we often hear when people criticize the quote-unquote activist judiciary is that how can one person or a panel of judges, have more power and even if they disagree with the majority of the people? Well, the point is, majority doesn't rule when it gets into the judiciary. They're designed, that part of our checks and balances system is designed to protect the minority and those who have constitutional protections that may be usurped by the majority at one point. But that's the point.
Right?
The point is, the majority really doesn't matter.
It's their job to interpret the law that's in
here.
Place.
It's a matter of protecting rights, whether it's minority rights, majority rights, or any other kind of rights.
Okay, back to federal court. Judge Tanya Walton Pratt blocked a portion of the new abortion law that defunded Planned Parenthood this week, and then it was revealed abortions were halted at two hospitals prior to the ruling. About 70 women at IU and Wishart hospitals were denied abortions in the 6 weeks since the new law took effect. Doctors refused to do abortions even in cases where the patient's health was at risk or there was no chance the fetus would survive. A Wishart doctor says the legislature, quote, tied the hands of physicians in a politically motivated move to defund Planned Parenthood. State Senator Scott Schneider disagrees.
Keep in mind the intent and the fundamental reason behind the amendment and behind the bill was to make sure that taxpayers aren't subsidizing organizations that perform abortion. And we exempted out hospitals for this very reason. So certainly a little surprised that they're unilaterally doing this. It was solely their decision.
John Katzenberger, who's being political now?
Well, I think that the senator raises a good point, and I'll take him at his word that the idea was not to cause this complication. I mean, the decision was made in good faith by the hospitals. They were worried about their funding. The problem is these doctors aren't technically affiliated with the hospital. They aren't employees of the hospital. They're people who practice there. So I can see where there's a question. You know, the little shot that they lobbed over the wall at the law itself seems a little gratuitous. I think that they should fix this, and I think that the senator cast a position that he's open to that kind of a fix.
It's interesting that this didn't come out until after there was an injunction that made it a moot point. But clearly these doctors are engaging in political activity.
You're right. I mean, it is interesting that it would come out after. I'm frankly very surprised that given how highly charged this issue is and how much attention has been focused on the legislation before its enactment, before it was signed by the governor, before it went to a hearing before in federal court, that this didn't come to light. Because it really does show that it's more than just a theoretical. The implications here are not just theoretical, that you actually do have evidence that, as you point out, Jim, 70 people at least were denied. And what is, at this point, a legal, let me say that very clearly, procedure in this state.
So Scott Schneider says that there's no need to change the law. He has no intention to do that. But this just begs for a new argument in the legislature next year. Right?
It's Seventh Circuit Court will decide, if not the Supreme Court of the United States, eventually. And, this is consistent with what you're going to see more and more of. Not just on this issue, but a whole lot of issues where states are going to be more in a situation where they're challenging the federal government for different things that are going on. We see it happening all across America right now. Some 35 states have joined on a challenge to the EPA and how far they can go with their powers. And you're going to just see more and more of this kind of thing. And it's natural that the federalism and this state of public policy goes that way. And we're headed to a lot of it.
And we should expect, I believe, that some pro-choice legislator next year will use this circumstance as a reason to file a new bill.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a law of unintended consequences. I mean, the question is, did anybody ask any doctors about this during the session? They should have.
They did.
But it goes to the question of what was the priorities in the legislature to begin with. We did nothing on jobs, but we did this. You know, we did a whole bunch of bills and are now going to end up in court. That was a useful exercise.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. Last week's question was, is the newspaper industry headed for extinction? 37% said there will always be newspapers. 47% said daily home delivery will soon be a thing of the past. And 16% said that newspapers will only exist on the internet. This week's question is Major Moves a success? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C, ask me in 70 years. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The governor commemorated the fifth anniversary of Major Moves this week, the road building program launched by the lease of the Indiana Toll Road. It comes as the new operators of the toll road are close to default on the debt created by the lease.
The lease of the Indiana Toll Road will last 75 years. The owners of that lease paid $3.8 billion, money the state of Indiana already has. Money trouble for them has little effect on the governor.
First thing it means is we got a great deal. I mean, it means they overpaid. I have always resisted saying this, but it's now said so often. And all right, you know, that's why you hold an auction. Sometimes you really hit the jackpot, and we did.
But the people who drive the Indiana Toll Road will pay. Already the price of driving the length of the road from Ohio to Illinois in a passenger car has gone up from $4.65 5 years ago to $8.80 now.
It's getting pricey when you got to get down there, and it's $2.50, it's $2.50, you know. So, and now they're going to raise the rates again. Oh, that's great.
And all of the money will be spent by 2015 under current plans. John Schwanes, does this deal look better as time goes by or not?
Ask me in 70 years. Clearly has come out of this that's very advantageous to the state. Yeah. It got a great windfall up front. It's been able to do a lot of things in terms of bridge reconstruction, in terms of road repairs. infrastructure.
100 roads, 100.
And this wasn't part of the plan, but because of the recession, construction prices were at an all-time low. So arguably the state actually made out better. And again, that's no one's saying that the recession is a good thing, but the state made out better and was able to repay more miles and rebuild more bridges because of that.
Is it a good thing if the operators go into default?
I think it's really irrelevant to the state. It's sort of like if you sell your house on contract and the person can't pay anymore, you take it back. I mean, it's much more complicated than that. But the state, you know, if the operators go into default, there are ways to take care of it. I think, the windfall that the state received is good. I think that the money that's been able to be invested is great. But there's a long period between, you know, the end of the road building and then the end of the lease. The state has to continue to maintain the tax flow necessary to improve roads all along, and if it doesn't do that, then we may rue this deal.
And the Democrats don't want this to be a political issue.
Well, sure. There's plenty of things to look at. First of all, the money's gone in 13, not 15. The budget that just passed showed the Major Moves Construction Fund at $50 million in FY 2013.
Well, but regardless, that's the governor's goal. He's trying to spend it, and he's trying to get these projects done.
He's trying to spend it and leave the next governor with nothing.
You do have a reinvestment fund that some of these dollars went into.
The second thing is that the shape of the Indiana toll road is at its worst right now, and the tolls have doubled. And that's just going to continue to go. And we're going to see about how ironclad that agreement is if this thing goes into default. And we'll see if the creditors want to take little possession of it themselves.
The contract will still be in place. I mean, but the tolls went up because legislators wouldn't do it.
Well, they governors didn't do it for 30 years. So they didn't raise the tolls once in 30 years.
Right.
And so and we're still in the lowest five costs of running toll roads.
You worked for a couple of those people who didn't raise them.
The legislature didn't do it for 30 years, right. Dan. And so, look, this is the most successful program in the modern history of Indiana. Jobs, thousands of miles of new roads and improved roads.
Big part of Mitch Daniels' legacy.
Jobs when we needed it the worst, right. Quite frankly. There have been $755 million in interest made off of this money so far. And this is money we wouldn't have had at all. And so other states in the union who are not building roads envy what's going on in Indiana. This was a great program.
All right. A number of new laws take effect today, including the one that bans texting while driving. Under the law, drivers can't text, send email, or read texts while driving. But you can still surf the web and make calls while behind the wheel. And let's say an officer suspects you of breaking the law and pulls you over. You're not required to let the police look through your phone. The big question now, how will police be able to enforce the new law?
It is going to be difficult if somebody's got their phone down, you know, where we can't see it, we respond to a lot of kind of impaired driving calls. People call and they say, I don't know what's the matter with this guy. He's all over the roadway. He's drifting in and out of his lane. He's dropped off the right side of the road. I think those are the kinds of, once we make that traffic stop to try to determine what is wrong, we're going to find out that simply by asking, were you texting? A lot of people will just tell us, you know. So that's important.
That is Tammy Schaefer of the Bluffton Police Department. Dan Parker, good law?
Good intention. Good. I don't know how they enforce it.
So does it make sense to have a law that people feel maybe that they need to follow?
Mike, pay attention.
Mike.
You have to
put
LOL.
Look, it's hard to pull your eyes off those Anthony Weiner.
This is very important. This is important law. I think it's more important in a lot of ways than seatbelts. Because if I choose not to put my seatbelt on and I get in a wreck, I'm probably hurting myself.
Right.
If I'm doing this, I have a better chance of hurting somebody else.
So even if it's not a good law and it causes people to follow it?
We probably need to eliminate them altogether and go to hands-free devices so that people can concentrate on driving.
Yeah. All right. Finally, the Indiana Department of Education no longer requires schools to teach cursive writing. For decades, teaching cursive to third graders was a state standard, but in recent years, many schools have spent less and less time on the subject. So, starting this fall, it will no longer be mandated. Instead, the state wants schools to teach students how to be proficient at keyboarding. And Mike McDaniel, you just proved to us that you are
proficient.
Maybe not.
You didn't see what he was writing.
Can you?
He's proficient on a smartphone, but not on a keyboard.
That's right.
Could you pass third grade this year?
Probably not. I know I couldn't get into Ball State now.
Look, you equating that with third grade?
Well, this is one of those deals where 48 other states are going to this core competency program, and Indiana is also. School systems have the right, if they want to continue to teach curriculum.
They need to do both.
You need to do both.
Yeah,
you got to be able to write a thank you note, right? What would Emily Post say?
Emily Post? Well, she wouldn't say anything today.
Thank you.
And you can still write in cursive behind the wheel if you have a little scratch pad and everything.
That's so. Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Dan Parker, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast or starting Monday. You can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Week in Review under News. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.